This is Colorado Matters from KCFR News. I'm Ryan Warner. In the 1920s, Denver was home to a seamy underworld of mobsters and swindlers, and one man was determined to clean it up. Phil Van Cise was elected Denver District Attorney in 1921 and quickly succeeded in putting a ring of notorious criminals behind bars. His popularity skyrocketed, but his later efforts to fight the Ku Klux Klan left him an outcast. Well, now, some are waging a campaign to have Denver's new Justice Center named after him. Joining us is reporter Alan Prendergast of Westword. He wrote a profile of Van Cise in a recent issue. Alan, welcome to Colorado Matters.
Thanks for having me.
So what was Denver like back when Phil Van Cise was district attorney?
Well, it was a town that had supposedly lost its frontier image and become, a little more civilized. But as he quickly found out, he's a rookie DA who was a dark horse candidate, who hadn't been expected to win, steps into the role and is given a tour of the town by the police and sees that there are gambling parlors hidden in pool halls. The brothels on Market Street, the old red light district, had been closed, but they basically moved elsewhere. In short, there was a lot of corruption, a lot of crime operating fairly openly, and it was being done because everybody was on the take. There were people in the police, people in his own office who were being paid to basically protect these operations.
He does some digging, and he finds that there's a common thread between a lot of these sort of seemingly disparate acts of illegality.
Well, when he came in, it quickly became apparent to him the person who really was the king of Denver's underworld was a guy named Lou Blonger, who had been around, a fixture in Denver for several years, had run a saloon in Larimer, and basically was the guy the crooks went to make sure the cops stayed off their back.
You describe him as a fat, shrewd ex-bartender who had something on everybody.
He did. And in fact, he tried to get something on Van Cise even before he became DA. He had a meeting with him, said, gee, I really like you. You're a war veteran. I'll give you $25,000 for your campaign. Now, at the time, the office of DA paid $5,000 a year. And Van Cise realized that this guy was just trying to get his hooks into him, that a lot of his predecessors had, in fact, made a lot of money being DA and doing nothing. And he declined the offer. So they were bitter enemies from the start. And Van Cise was determined to find out what Blonger was up to and found that the real operation was happening down in the business district, where there was a fake stock exchange that was fleecing rich tourists every summer.
Blonger's folks would approach tourists in the lobby of the Brown Palace, you write, and reel them in.
Yeah, well, this was interesting. It was a loose-knit network of some of the top confidence men in the country, and they all knew to come to Denver. Denver was what they called the big store because Lou, the fixer, had the fix in. So essentially, if you've ever seen the movie The Sting, I mean, that kind of thing was going on. They would approach people, befriend them, make them think that they were in on some special deal. This would take days and eventually get them to put a lot of money into a spurious deal, and they would lose thousands, in some cases hundreds of thousands of dollars.
It was such a different time because I'm reading your piece and thinking, God, I can't imagine being approached as a tourist in a town and thinking, oh, yes, what a great business opportunity.
But, well, it doesn't happen quite that way. I mean, it actually was pretty ingenious. Very quickly, one person would determine that they were alone in town, that they had money, maybe some time on their hands, they'd befriend them. The person who then ropes them into the exchange, it seems like a random meeting, and it might take place hours or days later. And then there's another period of conning that goes on before they finally get to the point where the person is bringing their own money into the exchange and still thinking they're risking nothing. It was very elaborate.
Into an exchange, a fake exchange that's been set up with phones and been set up with chalkboards.
Yeah, and the beauty of it was it could all be taken apart in minutes and disappear. And so by the time, if they did bring the cops back, and of course they never really could, because if they go to the cops are in on this and also discourage the victims from making a complaint. Van Cise ultimately got onto this and conducted what I thought was an incredibly sophisticated and modern investigation that involved electronic surveillance, undercover agents, subpoenaing telegrams and phone records, and built a tremendous case against these guys without any help from the police.
You mentioned The Sting. Van Cise wrote a book about some of his experiences called Fighting the Underworld, and you claim it was an inspiration in part for The Sting.
Yeah, it's a little roundabout. What happened was Van Cise's book comes out in 1936, and that was really a fascinating read. It's long out of print. But there was a professor of linguistics who contacted him shortly after that book came out, was fascinated with con man slang, and ended up writing a more comprehensive survey about con men called The Big Con. That book, if you read that book, is unquestionably the source for the sting. I mean, it's got some of the same names are used of real con men and so on.
So he puts together this elaborate system to catch these guys. Again, you mentioned electronic surveillance is involved.
Well, this is 1921. Electronic surveillance consists of putting a dictaphone in a chandelier and with 50-pound wet batteries that frequently went out and having... I mean, the interesting thing about all this is Van Cise had to, you know, circumvent the usual police. So he went back to techniques that he had learned really as a military intelligence officer during World War One. You learn everything you can about the enemy and you infiltrate them before you actually attack them head on. And this was the only way to beat these guys.
Let's talk about the arrests, because he knows that a lot of the folks in his own government are corrupt. He can't trust, for example, the police. He can't trust the jail.
Yes. He knows that if he brings these guys just down to the city jail, very low bonds will be set. They will skip town. There will never be a case. So what he does is essentially, again, cutting out the police, he goes to various prominent citizens in Denver who had been secretly donating money to him for this investigation, and they agree to be drivers. And they essentially run around town, pick these guys up, and they took them all to the First Universalist Church, which was Van Cise's church, and locked them in the basement in the Sunday school room. And there are pictures of these tough con men hiding their faces from photographers behind their straw hats, sitting in little Sunday school desks. And on the wall is the way of the transgressor is hard, little Sunday school verses like that. He held them incommunicado till he could put high bails on them, took 20 of them to trial and got a conviction on every one in spite of some efforts to do some jury tampering.
Lou Blonder died shortly after in prison.
Yes, he came to Van Cise after the trial and basically begged for mercy. And Van Cise thought about it. In his book, he explains that he was thinking about this minister who had committed suicide because he had lost so much money in one of Blonder's games. And he said, I can't show you any leniency, not with what you've done.
It's Colorado Matters. I'm Ryan Warner. And my guest is Alan Prendergast, a reporter for Westword. His article on former Denver District Attorney Phil Van Cise appears in the February 7th issue. You write that at the conclusion of this case, he was probably the most popular man in Colorado. 2 years later, though, when he went out of office because of his fight against the Klan, he was probably the most unpopular man in the state. What happened?
Well, that's a fascinating story. Van Cise could have probably been mayor in 1923. In fact, there was a push to draft him. Instead, a sort of power vacuum was created by getting rid of these people, and the Klan was growing in power in Colorado at that time. And the new mayor was Ben Stapleton, who, as we all know, the airport is named after, or the old airport. And Stapleton had the backing of the Klan. Van Cise was very opposed to this. He tried to do a grand jury investigation of the Klan. He sent undercover agents to their meetings. And there's Stapleton promising the Klan that if they back him, he will get all the Catholics out of any position of power in Denver.
Mm.
And he did exactly that. I mean, he appointed a chief of police who was a Klansman. The Protestant police who agreed to join the Klan were promoted. The Irish Catholic police, of which there was a fairly large contingent, found themselves on less and less desirable assignments.
And so in this way, Van Cise was on the good side of public opinion when he went after corruption, on the wrong side when he went after the KKK.
Because I think he underestimated the extent to which the Klan had this tremendous appeal in Colorado, which had no history of something like this. And a lot of it was fear of foreigners. A lot of it was directed more at Catholics and Jews. There were some attempts to firebomb African-American residents who moved into white neighborhoods. Van Cise was one of the few voices trying to stand up against it, and he ended up getting literally shouted down. He held a meeting at the city auditorium, a public meeting where he was going to expose the relationship of various people, including a judge who was a grand cyclops of the Klan and later became Colorado's governor. The audience was packed with Klansmen, and the police who were there were Klansmen. They did nothing to interfere as these Klansmen got more and more rowdy, shouted Van Cise down. He stood there for 3 or 4 hours trying to give his presentation. There were actually shots exchanged as he fled the building. And, you know, at the time, he really failed. I mean, he essentially could not beat the Klan, but I think he sowed the seeds for what was going to come later. One of the last acts of his administration was to indict the Klan leader on a kidnapping charge.
So who's behind the campaign to name the new Justice Center after Phil Van Cise.
Oh, that's a fun story. And that was really, you know, part of the reason for doing the article was discovering there are admirers of Van Cise in the justice system itself. There are descendants of Van Cise still in town, very proud of him, but also Lou Blonger's descendants, who didn't know they were Lou Blonger descendants. A couple of guys in Illinois who were doing some genealogical research found out that they were actually related to the King of Denver's underworld. And when they started reading the story, they became enamored of Van Cise too. They also have a petition campaign going online to try to get the Justice Center named after Van Cise.
Do they have a chance?
I think they do. I think there are a lot of other worthy contenders out there, but so few people have heard of Van Cise. And yet when you learn his story, he seems like such an important person in his career was such an important turning point for Denver, going away from corruption, going away from the Klan, and really becoming, you know, sort of the model Western city.
Well, Alan, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Alan Prendergast is a reporter for Westword. His profile of former Denver District Attorney Phil Van Cise appeared in the February 7th issue.